Thank you for attending session 332, titled All Our Mormon Families. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. In case you didn't hear earlier, the pornography session is in 300B, not 200B. So I don't have the name. It's probably not the pornography session. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. We ask as you go through your day, you'll reflect on all the diversity you have experienced so far at Sunstone. Let the things that both uplift you and make you uncomfortable be teachers in your own journey. As you listen to the sessions today, ponder the gifts you have to give to the Mormon community and how you can share them in the fabric of such diversity. This session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Concessions will be open in the venue for lunch, or you are welcome to visit local restaurants in the area. Please return by 1:45 to get a seat in the next session. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your program, this presentation description is as follows. This panel will discuss the ways different kinds of Mormons live and contextualize the LDS concept of the family. LaShawn Williams is a divorced mother of three children under 10 years old. She is a full-time faculty member, part-time therapist, and lifelong member of the LDS Church. She still believes her family is eternal. Jimmy Rex has a master's degree from Arizona State University and received an honorary doctorate degree from the Secretary of Education in Mexico for his work with Operation Underground Railroad. He recently launched a podcast called The Jimmy Rex Show, where he interviews interesting people from all over the state of Utah. Geraldine Hasselpool is a digital artist and print production specialist. She lives in Provo, Utah with her family, where she works with the local LGBTQ community. Brady Williams is a former Mormon fundamentalist and reality TV star. Brady and his wives are featured on TLC's My Five Wives. Richard Osler and his wife Sheila Juergens, am I saying that right? Live in Salt Lake City. They are the parents of six children and two grandchildren. Richard's education focused on business. He is the owner of the Osler Group. In addition to his LGBT ministry, he serves as a Salt Lake Temple ordinance worker. Weston Clark is a senior policy advisor to the Salt Lake County Councilwoman Jenny Wilson, part-time, and a stay-at-home dad to two kids, ages 7 and 3 the rest of the time. He works on numerous community boards and chairs the Salt Lake Planning Commission. Weston and his husband are raising their kids in Salt Lake City. We will now turn the time over to the session. Each of them are going to take a few minutes to speak, and then there should be room at the end for some Q&A, and then please step up to the microphone when you come up to ask your question, because the session is being recorded, and that way we can capture everybody's audio. All right, so we are going to start with LaShawn. Yeah, 60 minutes.
Okay, so since we're recording, I'll make sure that I stand by the mic, but I generally have a very loud voice, and I don't have a problem projecting. When we initially did this panel as an idea, there were three questions that we were given to consider, and it was, what's the dynamic of your family? How has the dynamic blessed your life, and what challenges have you faced because of the structure of your family? And I wanted to share the many layers of my family dynamics, and I want to kind of walk you through them and then talk with you about how I make sense of them and how they walk with me into church every Sunday on the Sundays that I go, which is the days that I have to teach. Okay, so this is me and my mother, circa 1980-something. My mom is a military nurse, retired as a major. She worked in trauma and med-surg and everything else, and we were a single family when we started. So my mother joined the church in 1981. She joined in the military because in 80-ish, she heard that they were getting a new doctor. The doctor was a Mormon. Mormons don't like black people. And she said, well, I don't really care what religion is. As long as it's a good doctor, that's fine. He came in, and instantly, they had a really good relationship, and they began ministering with one another. His family really enveloped her into their family, took care of her. She was in the middle of her second divorce with my father because dynamics were that awesome. And they took her in. and took her to church. And we went from being a military family of me and my mom, and my, like, our earliest memories of me being in church, my mother, we were having sacrament. And it was one morning, you know, single moms running around and whatnot, so the bread's coming around, and she's like, take two pieces, you're hungry. So I was like, okay, great, take two pieces, right? Maybe I had done something that week, and yeah, I needed two pieces, I don't know. But we just had this entering of coming into church and coming into this really structured and organized process. She says that when I was little, I would look around our church congregation. I asked her, I said, Mom, are we white? And she said, no, and why would you think that? And I was like, well, everybody else in here is, so I thought maybe that we were too, right? So it's two-year-old logic. It's developmentally appropriate, so this is an appropriate question for me to ask as a child. So then we moved into becoming a part member family. My mother married my stepfather in 1986 or 87. We became a part member family. We are by culture and by roots Southern Baptist. And so we had the Southern Baptist, Mormon, military family thing that became us and who we are. Then as I grew up and dated within the LDS Church, I knew that having an interracial family might have been part of my future, so that's one piece that I'll discuss. And now I am the single black divorced female family dynamics. I'm going to kind of walk you through each of those and discuss kind of how it all pulls together within about 10 minutes. As military Mormons, I moved every single year, second grade until 10th grade, twice in 9th grade. Everywhere that we went, church was the same, family was the same, and that was about it. We began our moves through my mother. She got divorced twice, June 8th, 1978. My mother joined in 81 because had she joined any time before 1978, June 8th, 1978, Salt Lake headquarters would have heard from her, and they would have known it was time to remove the ban. But she joined after they got revelation, so now here we are. Part of my mother's conversion story was getting her patriarchal blessing and being blessed to have whole children, whole healthy children. I'm a preemie. I was born at 24 or 26 weeks, depending on which parent you ask. I was 2 pounds, 8 ounces, or 1 pound, 11 ounces, depending on which parent you ask. Still here, and, you know, fought to be here. My mother really loved the focus on family. She really loved the idea that she would have whole, healthy children, because before me, she had a stillborn. Before me, she had miscarriages. She had a lot of trauma to her body that impacted her ability to birth and to have children. So the church meant a great deal to her so far as family was concerned, and she passed that on to us. That's the St. Louis Children's Hospital where I was born and saved a few times. So part member Mormons, this is my mom, Deonce, I call her because she is like, her name is Diane, but she's basically Beyonce. So this is Deonce, and I just found out that my stepdad has like Jay-Z's cologne, so now it's like Jones Z and Deonce. Now, as a part member family, understand that coming into seminary at 14 and hearing D&C, these verses here, that say, this is the temple marriage piece, right? Their covenant and marriage are not a force when they are dead. When they're out of the world, therefore, they are not bound by any law when they are out of the world. So that's if a man marry a wife in the world, and he married her not by me, nor by my word or the covenant, then their marriage does not mean anything when they leave. Okay? So now she's got me, I'm the oldest of five, and we're reading this in seminary. It's an existential crisis, right? For us, like, oh, our families are going to die. We're all going to be, you know, off somewhere in the outer darkness, but, like, not really, like, the outer, like, sunset, dusk, maybe-ish area. Okay? So that when they're out of the world, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are appointed angels in heaven. Angels are ministering servants. Black folk don't want to be ministering servants here or in heaven, but here we are again with this part member family thing. Like, we are just, it's not fun. But now we're ministering servants again. Pay attention, okay? Which... to minister for those who are worthy of a far more and an exceeding and an eternal weight of glory. Like, ain't that about it? Where I come from, that would have ended very differently. But you see what our scripture does to us as part member families. This is important, okay? Because we don't talk about part member families that much. But here you have a black part member family, and now we're being told not only June 8th, 1978, but now D&C 132, okay? That impacts us. It impacts how we look. So now me, growing up being the oldest of five, setting an example, right? I'm going to get married in the temple. I'm going to do all these wonderful, awesome things. I'm going to fix this. I'm not going to be a ministering angel out there in outer dusk. Okay? So if the angels do not abide my law, therefore they cannot be enlarged, but remain separately and singly without exaltation in their safe condition to all eternity, and from henceforth are not gods, but are angels of God forever and ever. I just want to actually get to heaven. So if I can be an angel, that's cool. But I kind of like the God thing also. So, I mean, I'd like to progress, right? So this puts me on my path of I'm going to fix this wrongness of my part member family. So part member Mormons, I did not serve a mission, but that guy did, and that girl did, and that girl did, and the baby sister did not. But from our part member family, like this is our pedigree, right? I've got 3 returned missionaries in my family, so we're okay. We're always hustling for worthiness as a part member family. 3 missionaries, 3 full-time missionaries that served honorably and came home and whatnot, right? Cool, great. I didn't serve a mission because I was coming into my own, and I was like, yeah, if you ask me why the ban happened, you're going to send me home for my mission, so don't send me, okay? So part member Mormons, now interracial Mormons, military Southern Baptist family, okay? Grew up in North Carolina. And so I got to grow up with Spencer W. Kimball being quoted to me about what the prophet said about interracial marriage. So now this is in this whole dating, chase, right? So then you know what the prophet says about interracial marriages? And he says, cultural differences pose danger for marriage. When I said you must teach your people to overcome their prejudices and accept the Indians, I didn't mean to encourage intermarriage. He's honest, right? He came by it honestly. I mean, they should be brothers to worship together and work together and play together, but we must discourage intermarriage, not because it's a sin. I'd like to make this very emphatic. A couple has not committed sin if an Indian boy and a white girl are married or vice versa. It isn't a transgression like the transgressions of which many are guilty, but it is not expedient. Marriage stats and our general experience convince us that marriage is not easy, amen. It is difficult when all factors are favorable. The divorces increase constantly, even when the spouses have the same general background of race, religion, finance, education, and otherwise, says President Kimball. He then says the interrace marriage problem is not one of inferiority or superiority. It may be that your son is better educated. And he goes through this whole thing, right? So if your son thinks he loves this girl, he would not want to inflict upon her loneliness and unhappiness. And if he thinks his affection for her will solve all her problems, he should do some more mature thinking. I actually agree with that. But I grew up with folks telling me, not the entire context of this man's quote, but the prophet says you shouldn't marry interracially. So then what am I to do? I dated interracially because that's all I had at church. And I'm supposed to get a temple marriage, so there's white boys. So here we are. 94 to 2000, this is high school through sophomore year of college. Me am a white boy, okay? Missionary, didn't go on a mission. We just were on a wrong path together, but like united, right? So then I got it right and I got married in 2006 to my not returned missionary white boy in the temple. It was awesome, right? It was great. But then we opted to like no longer be married in 2016. Praise God. Almost 2 years free in divorce. Woo, cannot wait to celebrate in November. Amen. Okay. But now we have interracial families. And so it's a really important thing to talk to folks about marrying cross-culturally. There are conversations you want to have. Because now when we are a lot more active in exploring our faith and we're talking about faith crises or faith transitions, you might go from being a temple family to a part member family, and then what? Now if you're an interracial family that was already screwed up, now you're an interracial or interracial now part member, like these things can start weighing on you if you don't have your feet grounded in why you got married. That's an important piece. So growing up as an interracial family, interracial Mormons, both of these guys never had an issue with telling me the priesthood ban was wrong. I'm thankful for that because... But that guy was fighting against his parents, who were racist, and that guy didn't really realize he was racist until Obama became president. This is being recorded. Oh, okay. Anyway, we go from being these interracial Mormons who kind of like grow through and grow into, and really like you grow out of marriage. And you decide, you know, this is no longer going to work because I thought I was going to have these dark-skinned, wonderful, lovely, beautiful children, right? And all three of them came out white. One green-eyed, one blue-eyed. They're all super light. And I'm like, God has a sense of humor because this is some bull. And I love each of them individually and collectively, but it added another layer onto, okay, how am I going to raise these kids in this church, in my family, with the questions that are bound to come to them? Because I was always told that I came from cursed blood. And so I waited for my kids to carry along that curse too. And so I'm sitting here like I'm geared up to make sure that my spouse and I are ready to talk and teach our kids that they're not cursed and everything else. They come out pure white and delightsome. Okay? I am now a single black divorce family. So what does that mean in the LDS church? I'm a single black female, 3 kids that tries to maintain a co-parenting relationship with their dad. And this is how it works. So what that means... My kids always see us as a family. My mantra, F it, I'll do it. It's not what I signed up for, but it is what I have. And it's what I committed to carry because of how I believe in families being eternal. What I end up doing is all of these things here with my kids. None of it is perfect. But I'm constantly unlearning and constant teaching, deconstructing, and explaining to my kids what's right and what's wrong, and what they will never let anybody say to them without having mommy come back in and correct it. I have to talk to them about skin color curses, what it means to them to still be in the covenant and to stay in the covenant. But at the end of the day, It's these faces, through the battle fatigue, through the assumptions of why I got divorced because I mowed my own lawn, through the assumptions about me getting married again. I don't want to go to a singles ward. Don't introduce me to your uncle, your cousin, or your brother. I'm good. My maiden name, my married name, I'm still Sister Schultz at church, but my maiden name is Williams. That transition is big. But I believe my family is eternal. I've never fit into the mold, and I don't need to, but I believe that there is a mansion for me. This proclamation said nothing about me when I read it. It has nothing to do with me now when I read it again. But the family that I come from, Elijah Abel, and the pioneers that went before me, stayed here when people told them that they were not welcome. That stays true for me and for my family as well. So thank you for your time.
Sorry, I should have written down the order. Thank you, LaShawn. Next, we will have Jimmy Rex.
If you don't have a smile on your face after listening to her speak, you're probably just not a very happy person, because I kind of just want to, like, travel around the country with her, and we'll meet people and be like, so you guys are Mormons? I had such a different idea in my head. I'm the token single guy. I don't have a slideshow, but she's got a lovely family, so we'll just leave that up. And it was funny, when they asked us to speak on this panel, one thing I love about Lindsay and the whole idea of Sunstone is the doing Mormonism your own way. My big thing that I teach people now, or that I try to help people understand, is if you can strip your life of expectations and shame, there's really not very many things where you feel pain or you create your own pain from. And so one of the things that I experienced, so I'll kind of give you a quick insight into my life. So I'm 36 years old, never been married. I was very active, fully active every Sunday, 31-year-old virgin, up into about age 32, 33 years old. That was kind of my life. And when you grow up that way, at 30 years old, I was one of the top in my business in the entire state of Utah, doing everything I could with charity, family, friends, really trying to be the best person I could. And I felt nothing but like a failure in a lot of ways. And what I realized is this expectation of what you're supposed to be, what your life's supposed to look like, what your family's supposed to be. And that's what causes all the pain. And so I experienced at age 31, I was going to Arizona State, I was getting my master's degree. And when I turned 31, and at Arizona State, you got to understand, there's a lot of attractive women. And so it's like, you're like 31-year-old and 30-year-old Mormon guy trying to like do his best. I was going to like, Monday was FHE, Tuesday was with the missionaries, Wednesday was the temple. And every day, all day was like side boob everywhere I went. I mean, it was just like beautiful women everywhere. So you're really trying your best to like stay focused, do your thing. And when I turned 31, the bishop called me in and he said, hey, you turned 31, you can't be in the singles ward anymore. I was like, oh, I'm only here like 4 more months. So he's like, well, you need to go to a family ward. And I was like, okay, well, and let me preface this by saying, by the way, I got like 7 minutes. I feel like I'm giving an Oscar acceptance speech, but I know I'm forgetting somebody, but thank you. But anyway, so I, you know, to kind of give you an idea, the singles wards in the church, by the way, if anybody is from the church headquarters, I think you said you worked there or something, but anyway, you should tell them this is how it should work in a singles ward, okay? They should have women 25 to 35 and men 31 to 45. Those would actually be dating ranges you would want to date. Picture you're 31, you move to a mid-singles ward, your dating pool's 31 to 45. Like, as a guy, that's a really weird situation to try to date women in their 40s when you're 31. I'm just being realistic, right? So anyway, if there's inspiration behind that, hopefully they're listening. So I turned 31. Bishop literally says to me, he's like, well, you know what? We'd rather you not come. It's really like a ward for people under 30 and under. And so I'm like, and I literally turned to him and I just said, look, I'm not going anywhere. I've got a strong testimony. But you talk to my friends that way, they're never going to any church again. I said, by the way, this is the only church in the world that tells you at what time and where you have to go, just so you know that. And I said, that's something to think about. The brethren are trying their best, but they don't know our situations. A number of them are single into their 30s, so try to have a little more empathy next time you talk to somebody that's single. And then, yeah, about 2 months later, I started looking at other avenues, because it just felt like I never, and I kind of grew up feeling, for me, it was like, I love the Mormon church. It's my heritage. It's what I know. It's what I believed my whole youth and growing up. And it kept me out of a lot of issues. I took a test once. My number one motivation in life is curiosity, and my number one need is variety, so you can imagine. But what I realized growing up and being single was this expectation of what it's supposed to look like, your family. And it wasn't until about 2 or 3 years ago that I really was able to understand and truly grow a love for the life that I've created for myself and not needing anything to be a certain way. And that's kind of the message I like to give is basically there's so much beauty in the mess of life. And when you can really understand that, like if something's not going right, that's so okay. When you can really let yourself be free of somebody else's expectations, you know, when people say to me like, hey, you know, why aren't you doing this? Or why aren't you married still? And it's like, when you truly get to a point where it's, you understand that you're living authentically to yourself, because that's all I ever did. I was like, people kept saying like, dude, you should just pick one. Like, you're going out with girls all the time, just pick one. And it's like, who just picks the person they're going to spend eternity with? Like, that sounds so stupid to me. Like, that always did. And so for me, it was like, well, whatever. I'm just going to be authentic to my heart. And I honor myself that I did that because I never created a situation that, you know, I dragged somebody else into a life that maybe I wouldn't have wanted to have with them. But that's there is beauty in every situation. It's my favorite thing about this panel. It's just amazing stories of people. And so as the single guy that's kind of, I still love the church. I consider it my heritage. I just do it my own way. And I encourage everybody to do it your own way. Take whatever works for you is beautiful. And whatever doesn't, figure out what does work for you. Because one of the false expectations or false assumptions I had growing up in the church was that it was the only way to be truly happy. And I'm just going to be honest, it's not. I've got so many friends that, you know, I mean, I guess the last thing I'll say is like, if you're single and you're like, you know, I mean, he came to me about a year ago and he's like, one of my close friends, super, you know, active in the church, and he's bawling. He's like, dude, we need you back in the church. So many people follow you and watch what you're doing. And this buddy's a buddy of mine that I've been helping with a porn issue for like 5 years, and not anything wrong with that either. But his view of sex is that it's the second biggest sin you can commit next to killing somebody. Yet he has a physiological need of his body, so he's never going to overcome this until he realizes there's no shame about it and he actually gets a healthy view of the sexuality of his own body. And so I explained that to him. I just said, dude, you might want to consider there's another way, because I truly have never felt more liberated and just more of myself than when I've lived authentically to who I am, no matter kind of what that looks like on the outside. So as you listen to the other people too, I think it's just there's beauty in not having that expectation and remembering that you don't have to live in shame. Thank you.
I guess we're all looking at LaShawn's family. It's fine. When we originally did this panel for the Mormon Family Summit, is that what it was called, in November, I was speaking about my interaction with the Family Proclamation, which has not always been, never been good, sorry, not. And what the proclamation, so the first time I ever heard the proclamation, I was a young mother with little kids, and I was sitting in that Relief Society meeting, and it was read over the whatever the, thank you. My brain is made of gerbils today, so we're doing well. God said, that's not for you, to me in that meeting. I heard it. And because I was very conflicted hearing that. At the time, my husband was in school, but he suffered from some pretty severe mental health issues. And I knew that being the breadwinner for the family, it was going to land on me. And hearing those words that mothers have to nurture and fathers have to provide hurt me, and immediately the words came to me, it's not for you. It's not about you. And that was a really powerful moment for me. And ever since then, I've been, the proclamation has never been something that I've applied to my life. Now, years ago, I rewrote the proclamation to be more gender neutral so it would fit our family, and someone in Salt Lake didn't like that, and I took a lot of phone calls from Intellectual Reserve. And then when I told them to put it in writing, they told my stake president to talk to me about it. So we had some lovely conversations about that, and now I no longer have it. Last year, I redid the proclamation again, in a way that would maybe not get me in so much trouble, to be much more gender inclusive. As my understanding of family has grown from that moment when I learned the proclamation is not for you, My understanding of what family means has also grown. Years ago, the church said something about counterfeit families, that gay families are counterfeit families. And I was very angry, and as is my way as a graphic artist, the first thing I did was make some memes about what families looked like. And I created a series of families that were not the standard proclamation families. And I posted it online, and immediately people were saying, okay, that's wonderful, but what about my family? What about my family? And it's been years now, and that image, and I don't have it here, I'm very sorry, like I said, the gerbils, but that has grown. And I remember the first time I put it up, somebody said, well, my family is polyamorous, which means there are more adults involved in this family. And I thought, well, I'm going to add them to my graphic. Because what it came down to was the children matter. The kids in these families are what matter. What the parents are doing is, that's not, I mean, but these children matter. These children have to know that they belong to a family. So, and not that everyone has children, but anyway. So people were saying, well, okay, but I don't have children. I have a cat. That's my family. And I was like, you know what? Valid. Let's add that to the graphic. And I'm not trying to be a gatekeeper of families. I'm trying to represent what all families look like. And then I included my most controversial image, actually, is the polygamist family. But again, like, that's a family. There are no counterfeit families. My good friend from Mexico, Anya, said, that's really great. You don't have enough brown people. And I said, oh, you're right. So then we changed, I changed to include many more brown people. And then my friend Jamie said, that's wonderful, you don't have any Muslim families. So as the years have gone by, my image has grown and grown and grown, and families have grown and grown and grown. And it's wonderful, to me it's this wonderful sort of pushback on the proclamation. My mom every year asks for, sorry, and I work with Queer Meals, we now have hundreds of kids that call us mom and dad. So even our own family has grown and grown and grown. And our family is made up of all kinds of wonderful people. Black, brown, white. They're all queer. And they're, and like any number of days, our family, our house will be full with someone who's, you know, just a member of our family. And it's really wonderful. But anyway, every Christmas my mom says, I really want a family photo. I'm like, Mom, I don't know how that's going to happen. But she's like, no, your family. So this year my mom's getting, we're getting a drone and we're taking a family picture of like 100 or so people, which is going to be pretty incredible and will annoy her. But anyway, so as my understanding of family has grown, I'm hoping that the images that I'm putting out there and the stuff that I'm putting out there is helping other people's understanding of what makes a Mormon family or even just a family expand. Thanks.
Okay, sorry, LaShawn. I got some cute kids, too.
That's awesome.
Okay, so I'm going to call an audible because we have way less time than I thought we would. And what I would like to do is talk, what I really appreciate about this panel is each one of us has a different story to tell about a Mormon family and what that can look like. And, you know, the Mormon universe is a lot bigger than just mainstream LDS. And so I think when we share our stories, because everybody has their own story, and when we can share our narrative, it helps us to understand that the world's a lot smaller place, that we really share in many, many more things than what we're different. And that realization lightens our world and takes away a lot of the darkness. And so I want to share my story, our story, about an alternative family. So this is, and I'm going to just do it through some pictures. Last time we talked, Weston had all these pictures of his cute kids and his husband, and I was just like, you know, why didn't I do that? So this time I'm doing it. So that's me, and then Rhonda and Polly, Rosemary, Robin, and Noni. It's kind of cutting off a little bit of the words, huh? So we have lots of kids. I have 25 kids. This is a little bit older. And we, for all intents and purposes, we look like a pretty normal family that, so there's all different types of polygamous families as well. And my wives don't wear prairie dresses. I'm not saying that as a bad thing or a good thing, but we are different. You wouldn't know anything different just to look at us. There I am with my two grandkids and my youngest. So the dynamic, I have, she's 3 years old now, sitting there cuddling with me, and the mother of my two grandchildren is 25. So it spans time. I have some goofball sons, just like anybody else. I grew up in the LDS church until I was 16 years old, mainstream LDS. And then I converted to the AUB when I was 16, 17. And there I moved through the ranks, if you will, and became a leader within the AUB. And pretty soon things started happening, and I just didn't fit. And there were a lot of aspects of fundamentalism that didn't work well with me. And we, as a family, and particularly me and the wives, started to embrace a more progressive worldview. And as apparent in this picture, most polygamous families wouldn't see so much skin. My boys embrace the shirtless. But we still participate in rituals. Here's one day where I baptized three of my kids that were all born that same year, Mara, Tommy, and Rachel. Here's another cute one. That boy right above my head is Josh, and he joined the mainstream LDS church, served a mission in Ecuador, and just was recently married to his sweetheart that he found in Ecuador, and they've moved here. So we have a big diversity, and also the boy on the end, he just got married, and he's in the LDS church. There's so many for us to love. And I want you to see this, and I want you to understand that we're a happy family. We're a different family. We don't have just, I don't know what, typical LDS families, four kids. At least that's what my mom had. We have 25. And there's my grandpa, and I include this because this was a real big deal for my grandpa. He's multi-generational. My great-great-grandpa was in Nauvoo. He was a polygamist, but he was very mainstream. And for 2 years after I joined the polygamist group, he wouldn't talk to me. And to see him here with, I think I have children from... No, I don't have children from every wife in this picture, but three wives are represented in this picture. And for him to actually take a picture with all those children is a yeoman's effort. And the reason why is because I just wouldn't let him ignore me. And I kept sharing my life with him. And pretty soon, you know, before he died, he gave all my wives a kiss on the lip, you know, those sloppy grandpa kisses on the lip, and said that he loved them. And that's what needs to happen. And that happens by telling our stories, but more importantly, listening to the stories of others. And we told our story in a big way. There's outside of CBS Studios. I don't remember what show we were on there. There's all of my daughters. Yeah, that's Addison down on the bottom. It's my littlest. No, it's not by age, it's by height, because my oldest is right here. This is Carly. having some fun. Trip. These are my triplets. They each have a different mom, but they all graduated the same year, and they're inseparable as if they were just triplets. And here's those beautiful ladies. We went to the Rise Festival last year together and shared in it. It doesn't have to be the idea of a dutiful wife. She's my favorite, and I'm hers at least for a while. So I just want to talk and just say that everybody has a different story, and our polygamy is a different. We've embraced what we call a progressive polygamy, where we try to abandon a lot of fundamentalism, and we want to tell our story and have everybody get to know us and us get to know them. And so, thank you.
Hi, my name is Richard Osler. My story started when I was a singles ward bishop in the Salt Lake City area, and I had kind of two groups of YSAs that were meeting with me, the ones that would work through my executive secretary, and then about two-thirds of our ward was not active, but I was really active on social media and started to connect with a lot of those that were not going, and to the point where a lot felt comfortable coming to talk to me. And it was the first time in my life I started to hear stories of people sort of outside of my circle. And I maybe did 1,000 interviews with people that had stepped away or never been fully connected. And I always felt my job was to listen. After a while, it became clear to me the best thing I could do to heal people and to serve people was really to listen and hear their stories. And I became less of a fixer and more of a healer by listening to people. And some then were able to find their way into mainstream Mormonism, but some weren't. And I was willing to walk wherever they wanted to walk as far as what they felt was the right journey. Self-determination is a really important principle to me, that everybody gets to decide the right path that works for them. And my job is to honor that path, and I believe that's part of our doctrine. Now, there's some boundaries to that. ISIS wants to destroy me, so I'm not particularly, want to support ISIS. And the good work Jimmy is doing to rescue children out of sex trafficking, that's so there is some us versus them in my world, but it's pretty broad out there. Weston's in a wonderful same-sex marriage. I've gotten to see him and his husband and their family, and I feel no us versus them. I just feel, wonderful man doing the best he can in his life, and I honor his path, and we'll hear more about that and the beauty of his path. And the second thing I wanted to communicate is a little bit about LGBTQ. Diane Oviatt is here, one of my mentors as I got into this world. But I felt impressed to do what I would call a hard drive reset. And I realized straight people had told me my whole life how to feel about gay people or LGBTQ people. And I said, that's wrong. And the policy statements triggered that for me and a few gay people in our ward. And I felt like, you should go talk to LGBTQ people, and you will help, and this is sort of God talking to me, then you will help understand how I see LGBTQ people. And I didn't know the degree of homophobia I had within me, so I just felt impressed. I'm wiping my hard drive clean, and I'm going to go talk to LGBTQ people. And that's when I got much more connected to LGBTQ. Because I was into social media, started to talk a lot more about this on social media as a really committed. I still am a pretty, very committed Orthodox Mormon, whatever that means. And I'm totally in the church, and I totally believe in the church, but I totally get why the church is in everybody's path, and I honor everybody's path. And we started an organization called listenlearnandlove.org, and it's a content to really help more of us understand our LGBTQ. I like to call them God's LGBTQ children, not a different community. They're our own people. So if you want to learn more about some of the things that I'm sharing, it's at listenlearnandlove.org. And that's a website we've set up with a lot of content, podcasts, and stories. I love this idea of belonging versus fitting in. And those words are kind of synonyms for me, but I read a chapter in Brené Brown that changed that for me. And I realized fitting in is where we become something we're not to be able to fit in. And that is the sort of the square peg in the round hole. Belonging is where we're able to fit in based on who we are. and our authentic selves. And there's a need to belong, and there's need to find community where we can belong everywhere. And for some of our wonderful members, it's really hard to fit into the church right now. Jimmy does a great job of talking about how he was kind of being asked to fit in, where how he felt inside was different than that. And we need to do a better job within our church of letting people belong based on where they are and not asking them to be a certain way or feel a certain way or see things a certain way. So I believe very much in Big Tent Mormonism that the church, 2 minutes left, the church needs to work. There's no belief or behavior hurdle to feel welcome in a Mormon congregation, that everybody needs to feel permission to feel how they feel authentically and be able to share how they feel. And small ball Mormonism is where it's kind of the fitting in mentality that only those that culturally fit or, you know, you do a great job, LaShawn, talking about some of that tension that you felt. I just want to read a Facebook post in closing that I did this yesterday that's just kind of my way of sharing how I feel. And it starts, please don't let white people tell you how black people feel. Let men tell you how women feel. Let straight people tell you how LGBTQ people feel. Let those in our restored church tell you how those who left feel. Let one political party tell you how those in another political party feel. Let married people tell you how single or divorced people feel. Let legal people tell you how undocumented workers feel. I'm trying to listen better, first learning from people in other groups before forming opinions. For me, Christ washing the feet of his disciples is a powerful visual example of the humility I'm trying to learn so that I can listen to and learn from others, which helps me better see us all as all members of the same human family. It also helps me understand the nature of the cross my friends are carrying so I can better mourn, comfort, and help bear their burdens. Thank you.
First Sunstone, and I have to say, if I knew there was such a group of edgy people like you, I'd probably have stuck around a lot longer. This is very cool. Okay. So I know we're coming up on the end here, so I'll go as quick as I can. I'm going to read. I apologize, but it'll make me stay on task. Hi, my name is Weston Clark. I'm a husband, a father, and I'm here to tell you about my Mormon family. To be honest, it's a little strange saying that. I haven't considered myself Mormon in a really long time, but it is impossible to deny that Mormonism hasn't played a huge role in shaping my life and my family. First, a little background. Here's a picture of me and my sisters. My little brother didn't come around for another 5 years or so. This is probably also the year that my parents let me decide if I was going to get baptized or not. They let me decide that. Growing up, the church and its influence was everywhere, Mormon until proven otherwise. My extended family was incredibly devout. All church milestones were celebrated and broadcast far and wide. The pressure to conform was still was very strong from just about every angle, family, school, scouts. Thankfully, my parents created somewhat of a protected bubble. We were probably the least devout of my whole extended family. My dad always tells the story of his mission to Indiana, where he was there for 6 months, and he decided he was done, and he wanted to go home. So my grandpa flew to Indiana to convince him to stay and work things out. I guess you can do that. I don't know. Maybe you can then. And my dad committed to stay for the rest of the time. Grandpa flew home. 2 weeks later, my dad hitchhiked home. Despite both of my parents' mediocre devotion to the church, I think they felt compelled to expose us kids when we came around. We attended off and on through the years. I mean, Easter Sunday, for sure. And even though our breakfast regimen remained uninterrupted, my parents always gave fast Sunday offerings. Not much. I mean, Malto meal cereal doesn't cost much anyway, right? They don't drink, smoke, or swear, but my mom will say stupid and butt occasionally. In fact, not long ago, my mom divulged to my dad that she had been drinking coffee for a little while. That was kind of a big deal. I was baptized at 8. my older sisters the same day upon my convincing. As I got older, I continued to go back and forth with Mormonism. Pressures to be Mormon, attend church, and go to seminary were strong and omnipresent in suburban Utah. I tried seminary a few times off and on, with the last attempt as a senior in high school, early morning seminary, which, come on, are you really trying to chase people away with that? That's just silly. A lot of my back and forth seemed to correlate with the ebb and flow of my desire to fix myself. Here's a picture of me and my now husband almost 20 years ago, a few short months after we met. I promise we were happier than this picture makes us look. We were going for a mood, I guess. I don't know. This picture was taken shortly after I came out to my sister, because I knew my hidden relationship with him was progressing, and I had hoped she would take some pictures of us, and we had no phones for a selfie. It was terrifying to ask her, but she was the rebel of the family. That's her. She was the first one to buy me my first alcoholic drink, the one to constantly be at odds with my parents, and I felt like I could trust her the most. I don't know what possessed me to want the pictures, but I treasure them now, as some of them are the earliest photos of our forbidden relationship. When I finally came out to my family, it was incredibly hard. We have to be ready. You have to be ready and willing to lose it all. Luckily, I had an incredible network of friends that I knew would catch me if I fell. I told my sister, the photographer, first, and then I'm not sure how everyone else found out. I spent months in a bizarre fog where I don't know who knew what, and until at one point I just assumed everybody knew. There was a lot of not talking about it, awkward moments, and some weird anger that came out in bizarre ways. I moved out of my house to escape the awkwardness and tenseness of it all. The distance helped. I have to also think that my family's subpar relationship with the church also helped. I had an incredible amount of anger then. I know it came from my inability to be open, honest, and safe throughout my late teens. It came from the church's statements and stances on homosexuality, which overpowered already built-in relationships I had had for my whole life with family and friends. It came from that incredibly awkward feeling I'd get with every girl I took to a school dance, every lie I had to tell about my feelings, every night I stayed up crying due to utter hopelessness, every feeling I had and hated and repressed, and every adolescent milestone I passed through with unfathomable amounts of terror, depression, and embarrassment. If they see me dance, will they think I'm gay? If I don't hold her hand right, will they think I'm gay? If I don't like the right music, am I flirting correctly? Am I walking correctly? What's the one thing that's going to give me away? I was robbed of this time in my life by a culture bent on crushing me. Certainly, the LDS Church was as much a product of the times as any other homophobic institution, but it was my institution. It was the one that was supposed to be perfect. It was the one true church on this planet. It was the system of living my entire extended family was devoted to, and it was rejecting me. Brandon and I moved out of Utah together, spending a year outside of Zion. I missed my family incredibly. My nieces and nephews were beginning to be born, so daringly we moved back. I think when you grow up gay in Utah, you develop a bit of an activist heart. Adversity becomes your safe place of comfort. We bought a house together and soon decided to grow our family. It was illegal at the time for us to do it, but we found a way. I have no doubt that the Mormon cultural devotion to family and ingrained need to have kids played a role in that decision. So in 2010, we created our own path to adopt our son Xander, transforming our lives forever. 3 years later, and I'm running out of time, so I'm going to have to go a little faster, I'm sorry. 3 years later, we decided to do it again, and in the course of 1 month, December 13th, we bought a new house, we moved, we got married on live TV, and flew to Michigan to await the birth of our baby girl, Zoe. And there she is. Since then, we've become just about as boring as any other family in the world. We are soccer dads, dance dads, vacation dads, field trip dads, camping dads, and even hair dads. Okay, I'm the hair dad. That's me. Here we are just last fall. This family is my everything in the whole world, and I have 1 minute. Oh, dear. Our relationship with the church continues to evolve. Even though I have mentally and spiritually parted ways with the church long ago, it still plays a heavy role in my life. I have zero relationship with many of my extended family that I was close to growing up. Some of that is due to aging and geographic distance, but many of those relationships exploded in a blaze of Facebook glory during Proposition 8, marriage equality, and of course the more recent rule regarding children of same-sex parents. Even without an explosion or parting words, the awkwardness of my family dealing with my sexuality was too much for most of our relationship to take, and they were never the same. I'm out of time, but I'm just going to like summarize the rest. Is that okay if I do that? You know, Mormonism plays a huge role in our family still. My rebel sister is now the most devout LDS of my entire immediate family. And in fact, we do what we can to support her family. And this is us attending my niece's baptism not too long ago. That's my son and my niece Ari. And I can tell you that the conversation in the car with my kids on the way there was incredibly awkward because they don't know what it was, so we explained what it was. My kids are biracial. We think it's important to be incredibly honest to them about race, racism, prejudice. They live in a same-sex parent family. We talk about homophobia all the time. And so we tell them very bluntly about the LDS Church stance on same-sex families and how they really cannot be, they can't do what their cousins are doing without disavowing their parents. And that's like an incredible burden to put on the shoulders of children, and I can't believe it. So I guess that's it. I do want to say I care. Here's a picture of me now. My husband. Now, let's see. I'm sorry. I'm gonna finish this off. Okay, here we go. I mentioned that at one time I was incredibly angry at the church, and certainly there's a lot of anger still there. It is another archaically minded archaically minded organizations and institutions robbed me of much of my youth and happiness for many, many years, and that is hard to forgive, and there are kids still working their way through the gauntlet. But I've grown, I've learned to love so many things the church has given me, and realize how much of me is a product of the culture and environment I was raised. It has given me a love for my community and for my family. I grew up with those things being the pinnacle of everything important in life. And so, as an obedient follower of these ideals, I'm now a family man with a family I would do anything for, fight for, and stand up for whenever I can. I care deeply about my community and love to help my neighbors where I can. For those reasons, I can probably thank the church for my family, and I can probably thank them for making me a Democrat, too. In many ways, the church created me and then rejected me, which is incredibly hurtful. I believe there is so much potential for the church to actually lead with the foundation of the family. All they have to do is broaden their definition to include all families, single-parent families, families of one, families with two dads, etc. It is so simple. Love one another. Thank you.
Were you all going to sit in these chairs, or we got 5 minutes? Okay. We got 5 minutes for Q&A.
I guess I'll turn around because I just want to pay a little homage to Jimmy. I don't think we know each other so well, but I'm at Keller Williams Real Estate in Orem, which he had a big part in founding. And without getting into much detail, when I left my normal relationship with the church, I left my career path I was in behind, and I also lost a lot of faith in our country during the 2016 election cycle. It put me into a lot of depression that work at Keller Williams has brought me out of. And so I feel like even if you're single, you started a family that's very important for me. So I just appreciate that.
Question is for Brady. How do you support 5 wives and 25 kids?
I've been self-employed for quite a while, and I do really well financially. And the wives all do their part, too. So, yep, we take care of them. Lots of Costco visits.
We do now. My question is partly for Richard. It seems like a lot of these Mormon families, since they don't fit inside the box, have been marginalized and thrust out of the church and things like that. And Richard, in his presentation, he also said that the November policy was wrong. I guess my question is as we're trying to normalize all of our different Mormon families, how do we deal with that with the church, and how do you, because apparently you're still a member, and as far as I understand, excommunication is mandatory when anyone says any church policy is wrong. Quote, I think that the Church Handbook 1 defines apostasy as opposition to church practices, and so how do you maintain your membership?
Great question. I probably wouldn't be as blunt as maybe I said it that way. I just was always felt uncomfortable with the November policy. It was like a fallen domino for me, where a domino fell for me, and it hit some dominoes that haven't fallen. So I still believe in the church. I honor the church. I invite everybody to follow, but I just honor everybody that chooses a different path. And so I'm not an activist. I felt like my role in the church is not to be an activist, suggesting what the church leaders should be doing. I privately would love to see some things being done that aren't being done, but I just felt my job is to not sort of go down that path and sort of be someone from the inside. I love this quote I saw the other day. It doesn't directly answer your question, but it sort of frames up how I feel. We as members of the church need to stop focusing on we need to love people because our love will bring them back to the church, and instead focus on we need to love people because they deserve to be loved. So I love that framework. And so I don't really have answers to all your questions, except I know how to love everybody. And I think we all are trying to do that as best we can and honor everybody with their individual paths.
Question for Brady. I'd like to know where you live. Is that okay? In the valley?
Are you?
Why? Do you live in... I want to know if your LDS neighbors are friendly to you.
Yeah. In a broader answer to that, if I'm friendly to people, they're friendly back. And I think that goes with everybody. So, okay. And yeah, so we're pretty accepted.
1 minute.
I've got a how to best be an ally question. I'm a member of the bishopric in my ward and try to be open and the person that people can talk to, and it started to happen. A man who's married and has kids recently came out to me. I think he's not necessarily not out to to people, but he's struggling with that situation. How do I both honor his choice to be married and also honor his identity as a gay man?
I'd say two things. One is it's a great compliment to you that he came out to you. That is one of the greatest compliments, and I know Diane and Geralee have had that happen to them. It's one of the greatest compliments you can receive. I think I love this principle of self-determination, that everybody, at the end of the day, our job as family members, as church leaders, as friends, is to help people make good decisions that are right for them. So I love this idea of self-determination, that I don't project somebody's path for them, that I just walk with them and help them make as good a choice as possible. And I think that's within our doctrine. So that's my quick answer to that very good question. But you might talk to Diane. She'd have some great ideas. And Geralee.
I'd love to hear Weston.
Or Weston's answer. Great.
It's lunch anyway, right?
I don't know that I have a good answer for that. I mean, that's a position that I was never in, so I really don't have a great answer to that. I think being there and listening and being a support, I think he's probably going to go through an interesting journey over the next couple of years, and so being there and being supportive of wherever he's at is probably the best thing that you can do, because there's a lot that he's going to have to figure out for himself.
And so I would just say, Bishop, remind him that the things that he loves that are true are still true. Does that make sense? Like the things that he loves and the things that he's done up to this point, it's still true. It's still love. It's still real. It's still valid. And he has more exploration to do. And that it's okay. That if this isn't the definition of agency at work and intelligence at work, I don't know what else is. But the sacrifice that he has placed himself in and the love that he has for his family is why he's struggling, because he loves it, because it's real, because it's true. And our baptismal covenants say we mourn with those who mourn and comfort those in need of comfort. And that's really, that's it. just mourn with him as he mourns, comfort him as he needs comfort, and let him know that everything that's true, that he loves, and that's real, it's still real. Like, I think the biggest piece of it is feeling like you have to lose. You lose so much as it is, feeling like you lose stuff, and it's like, was that even true? Was that even real? If it was good to you, yeah, it was. And to be able to hold the tension and hold the opposition.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming.